Thanks for listening to the Best of Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
This is the Best of the Herd with Colin Cowherd on Fox Sports Radio.
Ah, it is a Tuesday. I know I don't sound great. Feel good, though. Live in Los Angeles, it's The Herd. Wherever you may be and however you may be listening, iHeartRadio, Fox Sports Radio, FS1, I'm not going to sit around at home for another day feeling good, sounding lousy, and talk to myself. I had to get in Herd Hierarchy 1 hour from now. By the way, we really have some really interesting teams in the NFL. My Herd Hierarchy, I left two teams out. And I think they're teams that are really close to a Super Bowl bubble. We've got some dynamic young quarterbacks and interesting teams. These games are so much fun to watch now. I mean, last week I'm watching Trevor Lawrence and Joe Burrow. And completely entertained, Joy Taylor is joining me today. We match.
So it's a blue day. We're glad to have you back. I'm glad you're feeling better.
And by the way, I'm sick and feel fine this morning. And Joy is the first person to reach out and sent me a Santa Monica restaurant and chicken noodle soup. So we got each other's back. I totally appreciate that. It's interesting. I'm watching the Chargers. You know, nobody's lost more games over the last 20 years in the NFL they should have won than the Chargers. Block kicks, goal post, doink here, doink there. It's just a sea of craziness. Is Justin Herbert so good he can pull them out of the losing abyss and get them to a Super Bowl or a conference championship? I just want to throw some numbers at you. And these are substantial. And they all, when you distill them down, come down to the same thing. He just had his sixth game with three touchdowns and no picks. And he's only played 19, and he's already on his second coach. He's the first quarterback ever to complete 500 passes before his 20th birthday. And here's one of the things about Justin Herbert that I love. I'm going to speak for guys right now. We have egos, and it's the testosterone, I think, and it's the egos. Guys, if they have a strength, they have to show it off. If a guy's got a great build, he always wears one T-shirt size too small. If a guy is funny, he's genuinely a funny guy, then he's the guy telling the jokes at the bar or the cocktail party. If a guy's brilliant, he's super smart, he's got to go to social media and rip people and show you how smart he is. We just can't help ourselves. We cannot help ourselves. We are show-offs. And in the NFL for quarterbacks, when they have big arms, you can go back to Joe Namath. He had to show you how big the arm was. Brett Favre, Big Ben. John Elway, Stanford guy. He wanted you to know, I'm going to squeeze this thing in that little keyhole. Jay Cutler, don't have to be great all the time. Zach Wilson now plays. He wants you to know he's got a great arm. The key to Justin Herbert's game is humility. He's got a cannon, and he could throw the ball through a battleship, and he rarely does. When he makes a mistake, it's because he doesn't pick up a read against Dallas in the red zone. He just doesn't see a defender. To have that kind of arm and to not at 23 years old constantly show it off with those receivers is really amazing. It's like having the best build in a gym and wearing a loose sweatshirt. It's like being the smartest guy in the world and not going to show off on Twitter. It's like being hysterically funny, going to a party and never telling a joke. Maybe one as you leave the party. This kid is 6'6", 238, a huge arm, 4-point major in biology. I like Derek Carr, but how small did Derek Carr look next to him? Derek Carr is 6'2 and a half, 212. Justin Herbert's 4 inches bigger, 3.5 inches bigger, and 25 pounds with a significantly better arm, and he only uses it sparingly. And this kid grew up, and I think a lot of this is, and that you see this all the time in a lot of industries, he was a late bloomer. He wasn't a five-star recruit. He didn't have coaches telling him how great. Didn't have Alabama coming after him in Ohio State. Small-town kid, grew up in the shadow at the University of Oregon. And so he was humbled early. He wasn't the biggest, strongest, coolest guy early. And as he developed, I've seen this my entire life with guys. When you're a late bloomer, you have this gratefulness and this humility. And I know it sounds weird. He plays with humility. But in my entire life, the biggest armed guy in the NFL often throws the most interceptions. And the way he plays, and you can tell his team trusts him. I say this all the time. A coaching staff will tell you what they think about your quarterback by the plays they dial up. This is becoming one of these teams that goes for it in fourth and four all the time. Brandon Staley, the head coach, talked about the team's trust. The kid's 23 years old. He's got 19 starts. That's what you do with Brady. That's what you do with Peyton Manning. That's what you do with Aaron Rodgers. Fourth and four against an undefeated team, Monday Night Football. We're going to go for it. Brandon Staley.
And that's what he earns on a day-to-day basis with how hard he works and how he prepares and then how well he performs in those got-to-have-it situations. And he's got that cool, calm composure that affects everybody in a positive way, including me. And I felt like he executed very well tonight.
There's a quote years ago from an NFC scout that was talking about Justin Herbert. Everybody said the scout's going to knock him. Is he too nice? Is he too nerdy? Is he too introverted? That's a bunch of bull blank. He's super smart, tough as blank. He doesn't have that Joe Burrow confidence yet. He's a late blooming kid, under-recruited. Eugene was his home, and being a Duck quarterback was a pinnacle. He's just growing up as a young man. He doesn't yet even know how great he can be. We talked about this. Joy and I would go on the air and we're like, he's 6'6", 240 runs. We don't understand. We watched them in the Rose Bowl. And Joy and I came on the day after the Rose Bowl, probably the best Wisconsin defense in my life. And we're like, well, I don't understand why everybody doesn't like Joe. I don't understand why everybody doesn't like Justin Herbert. A lot of it is late bloomer, plays with humility. Kid has no idea. And I want to shift to Mac Jones because Mac Jones, I believe, let's talk about that. I didn't get to talk about Brady and Mac Jones. So Justin Herbert doesn't know how good he is. He's going to explode through this ceiling. And I'm watching Mac Jones, and I think what you see with Mac Jones is what you see is what you get. This is it. I mean, he'll get a little better, but, you know, he had 18 straight completions, runs the offense, puts him in the right position. You saw him. I thought he played really well. He's stepping back off the line. He's calling audibles as a kid. It was very interesting as I watched that game. And there was a singular player in that Patriots game that really set it all for me. And he works hard, and he deserves a lot of credit. His name is Jakobi Meyers. He's an undrafted wide receiver. He has become the primary target for Mac Jones. Undrafted. He was also there when Brady was there. And that's why Tom left. Not a personal shot at Jakobi Meyers. Is this league, as you look around last night, all the talent for the Raiders and this weekend, Arizona, Seattle, look at all the wide receiver talent. It doesn't. You pick the team, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Buffalo, Tampa. Tom Brady goes into that stadium, doesn't play well. His warm weather team doesn't play well. He's on the road. He probably has the second best coach in the game. And Brady wins as Mac Jones plays brilliantly. That is why Brady left. I mean, Mac Jones is great. He's an operator. He'll be as good as his parts. I cannot think of another player ever, a quarterback who had significantly better weapons in his last year in college than his first year in the NFL. And it, my friends, is not close. He had better college offensive teammates than New England. And it's not like Belichick hasn't tried. The Mohamed Sanu trade, bust. N'Keal Harry pick, bust. Sony Michel, no longer with the team. As I watch that game, I'm like, this is why Tom left. New England has to play perfect football to win. And they almost did. They had a fumble, and they had a field goal hit the crossbar. Otherwise, they played really, really well. Tom Brady wanted to be the man. He didn't want to be the only man. That game is the future of New England. They have a hole. Nobody is perfect in the salary cap era. The Chiefs defense, really struggling. Right? The Chiefs defense, Super Bowl favorites, really struggling. Nobody's perfect. But what you can't be is slow. The game, the quarterbacks, the wide receiver talent has never been more dynamic. And New England, for the third or fourth year in a row, has no deep threat, no playmakers, not dynamic, and now a quarterback who they're going to ride with for probably 10 years with an incredibly low ceiling. That game and the way they won it, playing imperfectly on the road, the warm weather Bucks up to soggy New England, is precisely why Tom left. They're trying to figure it out, and they can't. They just don't have any playmakers.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
So you may have noticed in Los Angeles, despite the Rams getting to a Super Bowl and the Chargers having a winning record, the Raiders are not only the most popular NFL team. The Raiders are the number one NFL brand in Los Angeles pro football by a mile. If they played in Los Angeles, it would be Lakers, Dodgers, Raiders, and then USC. That's how popular they are. 80 to 85% of the stadium last night sounded like it was Raider fans. You know, it's funny. The Raiders have not won. They're very unique, their fans. They have not won a Super Bowl since 1984. They've not won a playoff game since 2002. They've had one winning season since 2002. And the Raiders are the only pro sports franchise in America that moves regularly and retains 100% of their fan base. It grows. It grows. The Chargers have moved once up the freeway an hour and a half and lost almost all their fans. It is an amazing. If you ever get in a flight on Southwest Airlines on a Sunday morning or Saturday night, it's a lot of Raider fans during the NFL season going to their games. I think there's a certain ethos, and I think it's an important part of the NFL's allure, is that, you know, the Cowboys feel flashy, the Packers feel small town, the Patriots felt very corporate, and the Raiders feel like they don't belong, and nobody really truly wants them. And that's a powerful ethos to their fans. They are the outliers, the kids nobody invites to the popular parties, and their fans completely, utterly embrace it. I think this is one of the things the NFL's got going right now for them, of the many things. Betting is now exploding in America, and football is the one sport we bet. There's a certain scarcity of games and urgency. I think it is very smartly commissioned and run. Yes, I'm a member of the American sports media that thinks Roger Goodell is actually pretty darn good. But this is also part of the NFL's appeal. They got a villain. They got an outlier. They've got the team that nobody's quite comfortable with and fans that are a little edgy. But no pro sports franchise in America has moved regularly. Now they left the state. I mean, if you go to a USC football game in Los Angeles, if they have an ugly first half, you can see cars leaving. The Raiders have had multiple ugly departures from stadiums, provinces, area codes, and states. And I don't know if they've ever been more popular.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
Hey, this is Jason McIntyre. Join me every weekday morning on my podcast, Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre. This isn't your typical sports pod pushing the same tired narratives down your throat every day. Straight Fire gives you honest opinions on all the biggest sports headlines, accurate stats to help you win big at the sportsbook, and all the best guests. Do yourself a favor and listen to Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I also want to talk about Baker Mayfield and the fact that I really didn't talk about him much. Baker was awful on Sunday, but I thought it was a huge moment for the Cleveland Brown organization. Their quarterback was awful. That's as bad as he's played in the last 2 years, and he admitted it. And they won. I don't know. That's what good teams do. I'm not going to rip Baker because I've never held Baker to an Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, a Kyler Murray, Josh Allen talent standard. I don't see him as a number one pick, although he was. I don't see him as a superstar. I see him more in the mold of Kirk Cousins. I don't talk much Kirk Cousins. Kirk Cousins gives you three bad games a year because he's solid to good. He is not spectacular. He often shrinks in big moments. But I don't crush Kirk Cousins for that because I don't hold him to an incredible standard. I look in the NFL, the quarterbacks who I view as franchise quarterbacks, so I'm not talking about the busts, I'm not talking about the backups, the quarterbacks, and this certainly includes Kirk Cousins and Baker Mayfield, that I do think of as franchise quarterbacks, they kind of fall into two camps. Solid, you can win games, but they need a lot of help. Solid and good. And then stars. Herbert, I see as a star. Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray, Josh Allen. I'm a big fan of Lamar Jackson. He wins 80% of his games. Those guys will have stinkers too. But with Baker Mayfield, I bake in my expectations aren't as high. So it's totally unfair for me after a stinker to come out here and go, ah, he wasn't any good. He's going to give you two or three of those a year. And when Baker doesn't have a great running game and he's missing Jarvis Landry, he's not the same player. So I just don't hold him in that stature. I hold him a little bit to an older Matt Ryan. I think a younger Matt Ryan was better than Baker, but an older Matt Ryan isn't. Kirk Cousins, Baker, Jared Goff. I thought my takeaway from this entire game is that Cleveland, their star quarterback in a quarterback league, played poorly. He sailed everything. And they won. And I don't think Minnesota's a bad team. I think Minnesota's got a pretty good roster. I think Minnesota's got a pretty good coach. I think Minnesota's a pretty well-run organization. And they won. That's not a game Cleveland won the last 20 years. Cleveland never wins that game in 20 years. In 20 years, if their quarterback stunk the yard up, and Baker said as much, he used words I can't on television, they would have never won that game. So their defense, Myles Garrett could be a top three player in the league. Unblockable. I mean, literally unblockable. Their secondary forced Kirk Cousins into one of his worst games the last 2 years. So there's my takeaway. I can't quite figure this out. You know, let me add this. Nick Wright always says this about the NBA. If you're a star in the NBA, a star, Klay Thompson's a star, and you have a bad game, we don't talk about it. If you're a superstar and have a bad big game, LeBron, Anthony Davis, Steph Curry, oh, you're a bum. In the NFL, same thing for quarterbacks. If you're a superstar, Aaron Rodgers, you have a bad week one. We talked about it for 2 weeks. If Kirk Cousins has a bad game, we may not talk about it on the show Monday. And that's not a knock. I consider Baker a franchise quarterback, good to solid. When he's got a lead, when he's got a running game, when he's got protection, he can be good. And when he doesn't, he's solid. That's about it. Not carrying anything. But I'm not... You know, Baker was much tougher on Baker than I am today. Had a bad game. He's going to have two or three a year because I don't think he's Kyler Murray. I don't think he's Aaron Rodgers. When Aaron has a bad game, the ultimate compliment that Aaron Rodgers gets, I don't think Aaron quite gets this. Maybe he does in retrospect. The greatest compliment I can give Aaron Rodgers is we rip you for a singularly bad game because you have like one every 2 years. Like, you don't play like that. I mean, like Tom Brady won on the road, and what did most of us say? Tom wasn't very good. We never criticize a quarterback who wins road games in bad weather. Warm weather team, bad weather, go up northeast, no matter who it is, and you win the game. And we're always totally satisfied. But with Brady, we're like, yeah, Tom got outplayed by Mac Jones. Why? Because he's Tom Brady. Sometimes you getting ripped is the greatest compliment. Our standards for LeBron, our standards for Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady are so high that in a big spot to stink, it's like, whoa. Baker's solid. He was bad. It happens. It's not worth multiple segments. It happens. Cleveland won. That's, to me, that was the whole day.
Want more Herd? The Herd streams 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the iHeartRadio app. Search Herd to listen live or on demand whenever you'd like. Herd Hierarchy.
Time is now. Let's go.
The top 10 NFL teams according to Colin. Number 10.
LA Chargers. I waited to watch that game, and my takeaway is they're a 56-yard field goal by Greg Zuerlein from being undefeated, but they kind of gave that Dallas game away, and I don't trust the franchise yet. I think they're being, as Peter Schrager said, very deliberate in how they're coaching this team. I think Justin Herbert will only get better. I do worry about Austin Eckler's health. He's going to join us in 45 minutes live. There's a lot to like. Here's the most important thing. Their head coach, Brandon Staley, was the Rams defensive coordinator. He blew the Chargers away in the interview. Every week, they have held their opponent to their lowest offensive total. This is a defensive story as much as an offensive story. Chargers at 10.
Number 9.
Cleveland at 9. This is not a knock on Cleveland because they played the Chargers this week, and the spread is like a point. Right now, Cleveland's defense feels like it's better than Cleveland's offense. Jarvis Landry, we told you, he is the soul of this team. OBJ and Baker, for whatever reasons, just don't have the symmetry. I'll tell you what, though, that was really impressive is that on Kirk Cousins' 40 dropbacks, the Browns pressured him 22 times, and almost all of them came only rushing 4. That is a real factor. They are not bringing extra people, and they are getting substantial pressure on the opposing quarterbacks. This is a very good team. This is not a knock putting them at number 9. I just don't think if Jarvis Landry's not available, I can't put him higher because he's really valuable, clearly, for this offense.
Number 8.
The Chiefs, who beat Cleveland and worked for it. Listen, their defense is a huge concern. They can't get teams off the field, but they've had 1 3-and-out all year. They've had 6 punts all year. This is an offensive story. This is Oklahoma Sooner football. Are they good enough to win a national title? I don't know. But offensively, it's wizardry. Mahomes is now 40-10 through his first 50 starts. They're smartly coached. Mahomes is tremendous. But I do worry that their defense allows you to make Mahomes a spectator for long stretches.
Number 7.
The Dallas Cowboys. For the first time in a decade, I think they're underrated. I think between Trayvon Diggs and Micah Parsons, they have 2 sensational stars on defense. These are playmakers. Micah Parsons is a playmaker. Trayvon Diggs is a top 3 or 4 corner. The defense is fast. It is athletic. Dan Quinn, this is what he does as a coordinator, makes his players better. Dak Prescott, Sam Darnold was running for his life in this game. And Carolina, this is a really good defense, and the Cowboys scored 36 points against it. A lot of people overvalue the Cowboys. I try to stay away from it, but I think they have entered the Super Bowl bubble. This is a real football team with excellent leadership with Dak Prescott.
Number 6.
Tampa Bay. This is really out of respect for Arians and Brady. They're not playing like the 6th best team in the league. Their passing defense is the worst in the NFL. And they're also the 2nd most penalized team. Now, Bruce Arians' teams tend to be loose and play with a lot of energy and emotion. I do not love what I'm seeing there. They're hurting themselves a lot. But, you know, they didn't play particularly well, went on the road and beat Belichick. There is value. I may trust them more than any team in this league in a close game. And right now their defense is not good enough to blow people out. So I think it really comes down to trust. I think if they play all but a handful of teams, they win because they're so good 3 minutes and less in the game.
Number 5.
The Rams, who beat the Buccaneers. Now, I just think I'll say this. I'll give them a little bit of a pass for Arizona. Number 1 is they came off almost a Super Bowl energy game against Tampa. It felt like a playoff game, and they were completely flat. I mean, you could tell 2 series in. Matt Stafford missed on his long throws. They could not get Kyler Murray off the field. I thought it was just a good team with a stinker. It's like I said about Baker Mayfield. I'm not crushing him because he had a bad game. It's hard to win in this league. I still believe defensively they're elite, and I do believe the play calling is telling you far less play action than they had with Jared Goff. They absolutely trust Matt Stafford to throw the ball down the field. As I often say on the show, what a coach calls tells you what he thinks of his personnel. If they're doing a lot of zone, they don't trust their corners. They're doing man-to-man, which the Cowboys are doing more of. They trust their corners. This coaching staff, trust Stafford and trust this defense.
Number 4.
Arizona beat the Rams. They're spectacular. It's amazing. 3 of the 4 games are on the road, and they're the only undefeated team left. They're really explosive. They're really dynamic, and they brought on J.J. Watt for the leadership component. Kyler Murray, first time he'd beaten the Rams. That's significant. He was 0-for-4. Cliff Kingsbury had been owned. This is a real tipping point win for them. This was a big win. McVay had owned Kingsbury. This bursts it through. Only team in the league, 400-plus yards and 30-plus points in every game.
Number 3.
Green Bay. I still don't think they're hitting on all cylinders. The reason I put them number 3 is because the Steelers have a fairly vaunted pass rush, and yet Aaron Rodgers was pressured on only 18% of the dropbacks. That's very impressive. So they're getting the offensive line in shape. And that's been our primary concern, that and the lack of a number two pass receiver. But Randall Cobb had an excellent game. So the emergence of Randall Cobb, who Aaron Rodgers trusts, I've always thought their defense is better than people give it credit for. Green Bay at three.
Number two.
Baltimore. Folks, how long are you people going to hold to this Lamar Jackson can't throw the football? Get over it. Get over it. He can throw the football. In fact, I looked up a stat this morning. He averages 12.1 air yards per attempt and 14.4 yards per completion. That's both the highest in the NFL. It doesn't look pretty. It doesn't. It's Phillip Rivers. It can be really ugly. The ball gets there. He throws guys. He doesn't throw them open as much as an Aaron Rodgers. We got to get over this. He can't throw. It ain't pretty, but he is so dynamic running the football. It opens up passing opportunities that other young quarterbacks like a Mac Jones will never get. I've said this before. When you're great at something, literally great at something, you don't have to be great at everything. So he gets passing lanes created because linebackers have to stick like glue to the play to the very last second to play honest football against this run game. And that opens up, how many times does he throw the ball to a wide open tight end or receiver? The answer is often.
Number one.
A franchise I've fallen in love with. They're so smart and well run. The Buffalo Bills, best point differential in the NFL. It's not just winning. If you go to the history of the Super Bowl, the team that has lots of blowouts, that steamrolls teams, usually has a personnel and coaching advantage. They are blowing people out. They've trailed just 11 minutes all season. They've had they've had an issue the last couple of years, and it's been a lack of a consistent pass rush. This is a really, really well-run organization. From the owner to the GM to the coach to the quarterback to the coordinator, they just keep adding these elements for Josh Allen. And when you watch them play, folks, they are putting heat on you from every angle. And if you're not ready for it, I don't even count the week one loss to the Steelers. I swear to God, the week one for half these teams felt like the final week of the preseason because nobody played their starters. So since week two on, I think they're the best team in the NFL. And with that, we bring on, oh, by the way, no Seahawks. Why? What do they do well besides Russell Wilson? You tell me what they do well. No Denver Broncos. Well, Teddy Bridgewater is concussed, so today he wouldn't play, so I can't put that team with Drew Locke in my top 10. Raiders, I still think they're close. I don't think the Raiders were going to win that game last night. That's just one of those things. You ever go on a date and you know 5 minutes in it's not going to work? Happens.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
I mean, not to me, of course, but I've heard the stories for years and years. The next guy that's coming on our show, he's a terrific journalist and a reporter and an author, Seth Wickersham at ESPN. There was the Jeff Benedict book, which I thought was great. Ian O'Connor, who I talked to a couple of days ago, his book was great. That was on Belichick, the making of the greatest coach of all time. And Seth Wickersham goes a mile deep on this. It comes out October 12th. So these are history books to me. They're sports history, but they're great, great history books. And the book is titled, It's Better to Be Feared, The Patriots Dynasty and the Pursuit of Greatness. And let's bring him on. So fortunate to have him. Seth Wickersham is now joining us live. Seth, thank you so much. I know you're doing the rounds on this, and I've been a big fan and admirer for a long time, and I thank you. You did exhaustive research, and you need to be lauded for that because the Patriots are not the easiest team to do research on. It's Fort Knox, right? The gold bars, information or gold bars. First of all, your reaction when Belichick says, yeah, I didn't talk to him, this. I mean, it feels like Bill wants to, you know, delegitimize any work that can be somewhat critical of him. Does that bother you when he says that?
Well, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, first of all, thank you. Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and Robert Kraft did not cooperate for the book. I'm very clear about that. But I have talked to Bill many times over the years, usually on the record. And, actually drew on a lot of that material in the book because so much of it was interesting and never made it into any of the ESPN magazine story I was doing. And so, I think that at the end of the day, readers will end up benefiting from this.
Usually if a couple or a company has a big divorce, there's not a moment. It's a series of things and, it's a series of frustrations. and you go to couples therapy, you try to work on it. So I don't see Belichick and Brady as having a moment. You crystallize it or distill it down to a moment. But often there are discussions or frustrations. If I could say to you, was there a moment or two for Tom that we can kind of distill it down to, he gets in his car after that moment and calls Giselle and kind of made his mind up? Did he have a couple of those epiphanies in this process, this divorce?
Well, I think one of the big turning points was after the Falcons Super Bowl. They had just won their fifth Super Bowl together. And I think that Tom, you know, and people around Tom felt like that things needed to change a little bit. He wasn't the 25-year-old kid, you know, who had just come off the bench back in the early part of the century. And so he did the Tom versus Time documentary. He did the TB12 book. He really started to establish himself outside of the team. And then at the same time, you had Belichick and you had Jimmy Garoppolo, whom he was deeply invested in. And at one point, Belichick, it's well known, curtailed the access of Alex Guerrero in the building.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just a tough patch. And, you know, Tom ended up skipping the voluntary offseason program. He had that unbelievable moment where he said, you know, I plead the fifth. And so that's really when it started. All that said, Tom Brady made it very clear that he wanted to retire a New England Patriot.
Yeah.
And I think that if they had extended him with a contract that would have taken him until age 45 that he felt good about in August of 2019, I think he would have signed it. Instead, he signed what was basically a one-year deal with a raise and an out to be a free agent. And as Tom Curran of NBC Sports reported at the time, that he was so frustrated by negotiations, he almost left camp in protest. And right after he signed that contract, he and Giselle put their house on the market. And he's later said publicly he knew that his time in New England was done then.
The one thing, the excerpt I read a week ago, we spent almost a day on this, and I said, you know, you could criticize me all you want. You don't like me as a broadcaster, but if it got personal and you said I was a bad guy, and my boss was quoted in a book saying I was a bad guy or a miserable human being, that's personal. That's something I probably would stick with me and land harshly. There's a quote in there where Robert Kraft basically says, you know, this guy's a miserable human being. And I know Bill's history is he's held a grudge or two, you know. What is the current relationship of Kraft and Belichick this morning, do you believe, Seth?
I think it's a good relationship. I think it's worked phenomenally well. I mean, Robert Kraft will probably make it into the Hall of Fame, and I think that one of the reasons he will is because, number one, when he traded for Belichick, it's turned out to be the greatest trade in NFL history. And number two, he's been able to maintain and manage these personalities and keep the band together much longer than, you know, so many other people couldn't have. And as he said this publicly, it doesn't mean that it doesn't come without, you know, managerial challenges at the time. And that moment, that was in 2018, and he was in a conference in Aspen, one of these business conferences. And he says, you know, I hate leaving places like this because you're around the most brilliant minds. And I have to go to Detroit to be with the biggest effing a-hole in my life, my head coach. And all that said, I think Bill's public, you know, he's referred to himself as an a-hole before. I think he might actually be kind of proud of that comment.
Yeah. Well, sometimes grumpy people are. You know, it's interesting. There's a moment where Bill O'Brien, who certainly had some success at Penn State replacing Joe Pa, an unenviable task, had some, you know, he would win a division. He won a division with, I think, Brock Osweiler at one point in Houston. So, I mean, the guy can coach, whether, you know, Nick Saban just hired him. We can rail on him, but he's won a lot of games in a lot of places. There's a passage in your book. I haven't read it yet. Again, it comes out October 12th. How close did Bill O'Brien, do you believe there was a moment, granular perhaps, but a moment when he could have coached the Patriots when this thing, Kraft, Belichick, Brady wasn't working?
Yeah, so it takes a second to unpack that. So it's the 2017 season, and as I said before, Brady was getting a little bit tired. At one point he said, you know, Bill is so negative, and I don't want to play for Bill anymore. And at one moment, there's a meeting of the minds there, and Kraft and Belichick, Kraft and Brady are there, and they're kind of spitballing ideas. And, you know, at the time, Josh McDaniels was expected to take the head coaching job at the Indianapolis Colts. So there'd be an opening at offensive coordinator. And it looked at the time like Bill O'Brien was going to be fired by the Houston Texans. He was in a very public war management struggle there. And so they kind of thought, you know, what if like O'Brien replaced Josh, and maybe if Bill left after the season or he retired, you know, one day, you know, Bill could take over the team. And the appeal, from what I was told, was that, you know, O'Brien would be more interested in being more collaborative with Brady in terms of game planning and personnel. Obviously, it didn't happen. McDaniels never left, and O'Brien ended up winning that power struggle in Houston, but he once joked that it was kind of an empty victory to a confidant. He said, I was trying to get fired.
And that's something. Is there a favorite Brady story? And again, I put you on the spot here, but is there, in doing this book, which comes out October 12th, It's Better to Be Feared, kind of a definitive account on the making of the Patriots. Is there a Brady story that you really warmed your heart or you really liked, funny, unique, just something that stuck?
Yeah, there's two. And I mean, one of them, I'll just say briefly, was during the 2007 season. One day he had to watch Giselle's dog, and he brought Giselle's dog to the facility in a Louis Vuitton bag and tried to hide the dog in a coach's office so that the teammates wouldn't realize that he had Giselle's dog. But of course, word got out within a minute, and everyone was giving him a hard time about it. But I'll go back really quick. He always talks about his mental toughness and how proud he is of the mental toughness that he's forged over the years. And I wanted to know how that came to be and what were the steps. And when he was at Michigan, this is a key moment in his career and his life. The night that he told Lloyd Carr that he was going to transfer to Cal, he met with his counselor, Greg Hardin. And he, you know, he's complaining to Greg Hardin. In Brady's own words, he was a whiner back then. And he says, I'm going to transfer to Cal because I can't get up on the depth chart here. And what does his counselor do? Does he empathize? Does he give him a hug? No, he starts laughing at him. And he says, you want to leave? Go ahead. You haven't done anything here, and no one's going to care that you left. And that really kind of reignited a lot of Brady's internal competitiveness. That morning, he tells Lloyd Carr that he's going to stay at Michigan. He's going to be the best quarterback on the roster. And as we know, those are historic moments in lore only in retrospect.
Is there a story about Belichick? Does he have a soft side? Is there something that there is some empathy? I mean, because, you know, some of the excerpts, you know, he comes across as really crusty and really hard. But I, you know, I said the other day, Seth, I said it's like the Beatles. You know, McCartney was the visionary. John Lennon was the academic. And, you know, Ringo and George Harrison kept it light. Kraft is the visionary. Belichick's the academic. And Tom is the California cool, driven, willful, but kind of keeps it light. But are there moments where Bill, there is a shoulder there? I mean, is there a soft side ever that you witnessed?
Oh, absolutely. And there's funny signs. I mean, you know, Eric Mangini once played a joke on him. Eric Mangini and some of the coaches where, you know, they took advantage of his lack of technological expertise. And so when Bill came to his computer, there was an email that when he opened it, it started screaming that he was watching porn. And I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but it was screaming down the hallway. And Bill didn't know how to turn it off. And so he was banging the keyboard and he was cussing. And finally, he gets under his desk and just unplugs the computer as all these other guys are doubled over. But yeah, I mean, look, Belichick can be emotionalist. That's well documented. And I have those moments in the book. But there's a lot of times that he's funny in addition to it. And, you know, some of the chapters I'm most proud of are talking to coaches and just what it exactly it's like to work for him and what every meeting is like and what those hours are like, 4:30 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, and how he's able to sustain himself in this spectacularly unhealthy profession that he's now done, you know, 40 some years.
Yeah. You think he stays in New England? You know, I said when I saw your quote that, you know, Kraft ripped him, I thought, hey, boy, if that Urban thing doesn't work in Jacksonville, he's got a house in Jupiter and a great young quarterback. Do you think Bill retires in New England?
I think so. I mean, he's talked with confidants over the years about, you know, maybe would he be a vice president, kind of like what Tom Coughlin or Bill Parcells and Mike Holmgren did, you know, and that remains to be seen. It would have to be the right fit, but he's a coach. And one of the interesting things about Brady and Belichick together, and this isn't breaking news here, but it's just their longevity and the fact that they just keep blowing past all the off ramps. And, you know, at one point, Bill Belichick, he said this on camera. He said, you know, you're not going to have to worry about me being Marv Levy and coaching in my 70s. That next year he will be 70. And yeah, he's always had a tremendous amount of pride in his work. And whenever he left New England, he wanted to make sure that he left New England set up with a good roster and fixed at quarterback. That was very important to him. And so the truth is nobody knows when he's going to walk away. But he's kind of on his way to building that team, I think, with Mac Jones.
All right. The book is called It's Better to Be Feared. It's got a nice cover. Oh, there we go.
Thank you.
Look at that. Nice job. I don't expect you did the whole layout there, but it's very nice. No. Seth Wicker, senior writer, ESPN, used to be colleagues. He's a busy, busy guy and very, very talented, and I can't wait to get my hands on it. And Seth, congratulations on your work.
Hey, thank you so much, and thanks for having me, and thanks for all the support over the years. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Seth Wickersham.